This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. This is Gary Clinton, and I guess I qualify as your host around here. You wouldn't know it from what I do, though. Hosting mostly just involves telling you what program's coming up, and sometimes, after the show's over, saying a few words about it, mostly just telling you stuff you already know. Like now, when I'm going to beg you to please write me. It's easy, really. Just write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. Well, you can tell me anything you want. I'll be just glad to hear from you. Because, you see, as far as I know, it may literally just be me and you. I mean, you, right out there, the person now who's listening to this. Well, okay. I know that that's not quite true. But I don't have much of an idea who listens or why. Oh, I know that a couple of hundred people download this program. And I know that it goes out over two low-power FM stations. And I know that there's a couple of guys streaming it on the internet. But I really have no idea how many people are listening or why or what they think of it. So, if you feel like writing me, I'll be grateful. Oh, one other thing, since I'm rattling on with all this ancillary material, you can visit the website, too. The website is www.nighttransmissions.com, and I have some extra stuff there. You can listen to past shows in the archive. Sometimes, when one of the shows is based on a story that's in the public domain, I'll link to that story. You can download and read the actual story. Other times, I'll post stories by the author of the original story that is not in itself the original story. Well, I'd better shut up now. Come as some comfort to you to realize that I get paid about what I'm worth. That is to say, nothing. Oh, right. I was supposed to tell you. The name of the show is Whatever Happened to the 525, and it's from ABC's Theater 5, and it originally aired on July the 13th of 1965.
Theater 5.
No wonder they don't pay me.
To our commuters on the Northern Division. Effective Monday evening, June 28th, the Eastern Central Westchester system will inaugurate zone schedules for its rush hour commuter trains from Union Central Terminal to Westchester County. Please check your revised schedules for new departure time.
Hold the gate! Hold it!
Didn't you hear me?
Sorry, mister. The train's gone.
Was that the 525?
It's the 523 now. New schedule.
But why? It's always been the 525, and I've never missed it. Never.
Well, you did tonight, mister. Be another one at 548, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. It sounds foolish making a fuss, but you see, I'm very precise and punctual. I pride myself in it. Never late for anything. I've ridden the 805 in and the 525 home every day.
Didn't you get the new zone schedule last week?
No. Apparently, I missed it. But I never missed the 525. Never.
That's too bad. How long have you been riding it?
15 years.
Zone scheduling expedites the movement of trains through the commuting area and minimizes delays. Experience has shown that any failure of a train to clear a station stop on schedule tends to delay the following train. Sometimes a number of trains are adversely affected. Conversely, the faster the trains can be moved through the commuting zone, the more dependable is the service. Theater 5 presents Whatever Happened to the 525. The objective of the Eastern Central schedule changes is to improve the service for the majority of the 19,000 passengers using the peak hour commuter trains to Westchester County. To provide this improved service, we have added a total of 3 new trains to our evening outbound rush hour operation.
Is this your train?
Huh? Yes.
So did I. On my way back to school. I can tell you missed your train.
Oh? How?
The way you came in here. Most guys come into a saloon with their tongues hanging out. You know, thirsty like puppy dogs heading for their water bowl. They've been thinking about a martini or a double on the rocks for the last hour. Bang! Now the business day is over, and here they are, straight for the bar.
You're very observant.
But you didn't come in that way. You looked around, sort of lost, and finally you came over here. I thought it was Pickupsville. But you didn't even look at me.
Believe me, I've never considered the idea.
I know, I know. And the bartender came over and you couldn't make up your mind.
My wife and I don't drink much. We're not teetotalers or anything, but we never develop much of a taste for it. You know, I understand we don't disapprove or anything. In fact, we have very close friends who...
I'll bet you're the first whiskey sour he's had all day. Want to bet? I'll call him over.
No, don't do that.
Hey, bartender, over here.
Yes, young lady, don't do that. Don't be ridiculous. Never mind, bartender.
Another round.
Right.
Listen, miss, what you do is your business, but I've got a train to catch.
Don't worry about the money, Daddy-O. This is on me. I mean, if a misguided heiress can't buy a stranded commuter a friendly whiskey sour, what's this orbiting world coming to? Dig?
It isn't the money.
Fine. I'll buy you one, and you buy me one. Sound cozy?
Are you old enough to be in here?
You want to talk about age? Okay. Let's talk about age. How old do you think I am?
I don't know. I don't have any daughters.
Yes. I'm 5'6", 130 pounds, blue eyes, straight blonde hair, and I measure 35, 22, 36. If I drank less and rode a bicycle more, my hips would be 35. On the other hand, I might lose it where I didn't want to. When you diet or exercise, you take your chances. I know a chubby girl who lost 30 pounds by taking sauna baths, cottage cheese, and pills. She looks like a high fashion model now. But she lost all her boyfriends. You know how earthy boys are. How old am I?
Are you over 18? That's the law in New York.
I'm old enough. Old enough to drink, to swear, to marry, to have children, to march in parades, to die for a cause, or to live for a moment. Oh, I'm old enough, friend, and I'm ready.
Ready?
For anything. Laughter, music, cold showers, and warm pretzels. Anything.
Are you a beatnik?
Beatnik? Now, I bathe too often for that. And I don't swear enough or drink enough coffee. And my poems don't use dirty words. No, I'm not a beatnik. Beatniks are organized and poor. I'm rich and at times very lonely. How about you?
I'm 6 feet tall and weigh 175 pounds. Haven't gained a pound in 25 years, and I don't know my measurements.
Bet you wear a size 10 shoe. And you found it was smarter to buy expensive tailor-made suits than to have stock suits cut down to your size until the pant pockets meet each other at the back seam.
You're very observant.
You said that before. And I'll bet this is the first time you've missed your train in years.
The first time since I moved to Scarsdale 15 years ago.
15 years? That's eternity.
Not really.
Yes, it is. It's eternity and purgatory and perpetual care all shuffled up in one huge commuter ticket. Maybe you died somewhere north of the Harlem River with a backyard cookout steak in your heart.
Well, it has its compensation.
Name one.
Well, among other things, I like to broil steaks in my backyard.
Built your own barbecue pit, right?
Right. Sort of a family project.
When's the last time you danced on a moonlit raft in a cold swimming suit? I kissed a girl because she cried and her mascara ran?
Never. Neither one.
How old are you?
44.
No, you're not. You're older than that. Much older. 44 isn't old. Men still fly on their own at 44 and slap their women around now and then and drink Bloody Marys and aspirin for breakfast and lie to their boss about a strange one-day cold. But you don't. Maybe you were born old. Maybe you got out of the incubator and right into the Social Security line.
Why am I listening to you? Some little skirt in a terminal bar. Look, I got a train to catch. You are a beatnik. No matter how lonely or clean or rich you are, you're a beatnik. You hear me? A beatnik.
I know a place where the music is loud and a bunch of sweaty kids do the watusi in the fru. It's crowded and nobody can tell whether you know how to dance or not. You just wiggle your flammas and frown now and then. It's loud and dark and very young there. Timeless. Will you go with me? Please.
Just wiggle your flammas and frown.
Pretty, please.
It's crazy. I don't know what's happening.
You're happening. That's what's happening.
I must be losing my mind. What time is it?
Who cares?
My shirt's soaked.
You look cute all wet. It makes your hair curly.
Does the band ever quit?
Never. They're hopped up. Hungry?
Very.
Let's split.
Yeah, that's the wildest, smelliest, noisiest place in the world.
Having fun?
Yeah, how about you?
My name's Cindy.
My name's Clifton. Call me Cliff.
I know a place with red checkered tablecloths and yellow candles and old wine bottles. They serve chilled white wine from wooden casks and the greatest lobster in the Western Hemisphere. It's a funny, rickety little place built out on the water. The waves hit the pilings underneath. You look out into the darkness, and you'd swear the world ends right at the horizon. Or maybe even a few feet closer. My car's around the corner. Want to go there?
Sure. Where is it?
Wilmington, Delaware.
In certain instances, the new commuter schedules will necessitate changing the assignments of some of the train departure tracks at Union Central Terminal. New timetables, effective June 28th, will reflect these changes.
Wilmington, Delaware for dinner. I am out of my mind.
Distance like age is relative, Cliffy. You can be old before you're 40 or in Wilmington before you know it. It's up to you. You're driving. Just put your foot down.
Yeah, Martha will probably think I've been murdered. No phone calls, nothing.
Baby, if you'd called your wife, you wouldn't be here. Don't worry about Martha. You're a man, and it's your world. After 15 straight hour years, you've got at least one kooky night coming. Enjoy it, baby. And when tomorrow comes, charm your way back to reality.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm just sobering up.
From three whiskey sours? Come on. I saw a young man tonight, and I danced with him, and I watched the sweat pour down his face, and with each drop of sweat, he lost a care and a wrinkle in his forehead, and as his stiff shirt melted, so did he. Don't lose it, Cliffy. Tonight you're a man, a warm, sentimental slob, a a human being with weakness and joie de vivre. If we held an election, you'd go Democrat.
Is that what it's all about? A fiendish way to garner votes?
You'd look good in a beard, Cliffy. A touch of gray here and there. You got nice teeth for a beard, and that's important. Show me a beard with crooked teeth, and I'll show you a hungry mink. Do you mind if I lean on your shoulder?
I'd be honored.
Were you ever a teenager?
For a minute or so. Teenagers weren't in vogue much in the 30s.
What did you do on warm summer evenings?
Played baseball. If we won, we ate ice cream.
No girlfriends?
I went to dances now and then. The bands were bigger and half as loud. You held the girl in your arms then. It was a gentle time. The girls were safely home by midnight, looking very much the way they did at the beginning of the evening.
Sounds square.
It was, but I liked it that way.
How about hay fever?
Never had it. How about you?
Hay fever, strawberries, milk, cats, dogs, horses, and house dust. My allergist is a manic depressive. One day I caught him sitting in the dark sniffing ragweed.
Oh, that's not true.
No, but wouldn't it be nice if it was?
Sitting in the dark sniffing ragweed.
Cliffy, why are you here?
I don't know. My wife understands me. No business problems. My sons respect me. I don't know.
I know why you're here.
What?
Curiosity. How does the other half live? The young half. The front page kids who knife people in subways and smoke pot.
Oh, is that it? I want to smoke pot?
You want to be 22. Free to go or do anything with anybody. No family, no job, no what will people say. Just swing, man. Just catch a birdie's tail and hang on.
When I was 22, I was drinking powdered milk aboard a repair ship in the South Pacific.
So? Be 22 now. Right now. Come on. Come 22.
Okay, I'm 22. Now what?
Get us to Wilmington before you're 23.
All right, hold on.
Faster, Cliffy. This is a sports car. We're on a straightaway. Faster.
It's on the floor. I've never done this before. Hey, look at us go. Hold on, Cindy. Hold on. How fast are we going? I'm afraid to look.
Don't worry, baby. Just fly.
We hit 100 yet?
Long ago, baby. Just fly. Oh, this is it. This is the most. You're young, Daddy. Go, go, go.
Now, a flashing light. Look out the rear window. What do you see?
Don't worry, baby. You can take him. It's straight all the way. Faster. He's getting on you, Daddy. Step on it.
No, I gotta slow down. I never got a ticket. This is insane.
Don't stop now, Daddy. Go!
Oh, look ahead. Police cars.
Roadblock. Put on the brakes. We're gonna hit.
South Jersey Hospital.
Oh, my back hurts.
You're lucky you're alive, Max. So is a girl. The car's a total wreck.
You a policeman?
That's right. What's your name?
Clifton Fielding. What time is it?
Oh, it's about 4 a.m. Where do you live?
Scarsdale. I don't remember much.
Where'd you get the car?
Belongs to the girl.
She said it belonged to you.
Hmm?
According to the license plates, it belongs to a guy in Connecticut, but I don't think he's going to want it back. The squads are in pretty lousy shape, too.
She said it was hers.
Mm-hmm. Were you drinking?
I had 3 whiskey sours. Not much of a drinker.
Well, I can understand it a little better if you'd been drinking. Are you on junk?
Dope? Of course not.
Well, then who used the reefers? We found a bunch of them on the floor of the car.
I've never seen a reefer.
Sure, sure. Look, what made you do it, mister? Why? Why were you going 130?
130? I didn't think cars could go that fast. I don't know why I did it. I honestly don't know. It had something to do with freedom and youth and 22 years old.
I wanted to reach Wilmington before I turned 23. It all happened so fast. Funny, it's like a nightmare now.
Funny, huh? Well, it wasn't funny to me. I got a wife and three kids, and when I gotta chase some cuckoo like you down the Jersey Turnpike, I'm scared. If you and your little Lolita want to kill yourselves, well, that's your business, but don't take me with you.
I'm sorry. Believe me, I'm not a cuckoo. I've never done anything like this before. As for the girl, I never saw her before tonight. Is she okay?
She's pretty cut up. She went through the windshield, but she'll live. Won't be very pretty anymore.
Oh, no.
You know, Mr. Fielding, you're in a lot of trouble. We got you booked on 8 counts.
8 counts?
Reckless driving, doing 130 in a 65-mile zone, resisting arrest, driving a stolen car, damaging public property, possession of narcotics, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and violating the Mann Act.
Mann Act?
Crossing state lines for immoral purposes.
We were only going for dinner.
Dinner? A 17-year-old reform school escapee with a 4-year record for promiscuity? Oh, come on, Dad. Who do you think you're kidding?
But she looked older. She said she was older. Ask her.
She said you kidnapped her.
It was her idea to go to Wilmington. She knew a place with wine and candles and lobster.
Wine for a 17-year-old? Mr. Fielding, it is my duty to inform you that anything you say can be used against you in court. You're entitled to one phone call.
Can I make it now?
Yeah. You want me to dial it for you?
Please. Area code 820, Scarsdale 6, 1942.
1942.
Perhaps life is a gossamer shield between reality and darkness.
Yeah, it's ringing.
Hello, Martha? This is Clifton. I missed the 525.
The extension of new zone schedules is the result of Eastern Central's continuing program to upgrade the suburban service in a manner that will best serve the commuters' needs. Meanwhile, we hope the schedule changes have not caused you any inconvenience. Theater 5 has presented Whatever Happened to the 525, written by Jim McGinn, directed by Warren Somerville. In the cast, Stan Watt, Carol Ann Daniels, Jerry Hausner, and Gilbert Mack. Script editor, Jack C. Wilson. Original music by Alexander Vlastotsenko. Orchestra under the direction of Glenn Osser. Executive producer for Theater 5, Mr. Lee Bowman. We invite your comments. Write to Theater 5, New York 23, New York. That's Theater 5, New York 23, New York. This is Fred Foy speaking. This has been an ABC Radio Network production.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Lucy Perry. An Uncomfortable Bed by Guy de Maupassant. One autumn I went to stay for the hunting season with some friends in a chateau in Picardy. My friends were fond of practical joking, as all my friends are. I do not care to know any other sort of people. When I arrived they gave me a princely reception, which at once aroused distrust in my breast. We had some capital shooting. They embraced me, they cajoled me, as if they expected to have great fun at my expense. I said to myself, "Look out, old ferret. They have something in preparation for you." During the dinner, the mirth was excessive, far too great, in fact. I thought, Here are people who take a double share of amusement, and apparently without reason. They must be looking out in their own minds for some good bit of fun. Assuredly, I am to be the victim of the joke. Attention! During the entire evening, everyone laughed in an exaggerated fashion. I smelled a practical joke in the air, as a dog smells game. But what was it? I was watchful, restless. I did not let a word, or a meaning, or a gesture escape me. Everyone seemed to me an object of suspicion, and I even looked distrustfully at the faces of the servants. The hour rang for going to bed, and the whole household came to escort me to my room. Why? They called to me, "Good night." I entered the apartment, shut the door, and remained standing, without moving a single step, holding the wax candle in my hand. I heard laughter and whispering in the corridor. Without doubt, they were spying on me. I cast a glance around the walls, the furniture, the ceiling, the hangings, the floor. I saw nothing to justify suspicion. I heard persons moving about outside my door. I had no doubt they were looking through the keyhole. An idea came into my head. My candle may suddenly go out and leave me in darkness. Then I went across to the mantelpiece and lighted all the wax candles that were on it. After that, I cast another glance around me without discovering anything. I advanced with short steps, carefully examining the apartment. Nothing. I inspected every article one after the other. Still nothing. I went over to the window. The shutters, large wooden shutters, were open. I shut them with great care and then drew the curtains, enormous velvet curtains, and I placed a chair in front of them, so as to have nothing to fear from without. Then I cautiously sat down. The armchair was solid. I did not venture to get into the bed. However, time was flying, and I ended by coming to the conclusion that I was ridiculous. If they were spying on me, as I supposed, they must, while waiting for the success of the joke they had been preparing for me, have been laughing enormously at my terror. So I made up my mind to go to bed. But the bed was particularly suspicious-looking. I pulled at the curtains. They seemed to be secure. All the same, there was danger. I was going to perhaps receive a cold shower bath from overhead. Or perhaps, the moment I stretched myself out, to find myself sinking under the floor with my mattress. I searched in my memory for all the practical jokes of which I ever had experience, and I did not want to be caught. Ah, certainly not, certainly not. Then I suddenly bethought myself of a precaution which I considered one of extreme efficacy. I caught hold of the side of the mattress gingerly, and very slowly drew it toward me. It came away, followed by the sheet and the rest of the bedclothes. I dragged all these objects into the very middle of the room, facing the entrance door. I made my bed over again as best I could, some distance from the suspected bedstead, and the corner which had filled me with such anxiety. Then I extinguished all the candles, and groping my way, I slipped under the bedclothes. For at least another hour, I remained awake, starting at the slightest sound. Everything seemed quiet in the chateau. I fell asleep. I must have been in a deep sleep for a long time, but all of a sudden I was awakened with a start by the fall of a heavy body tumbling right on top of my own body, and at the same time I received on my face, on my neck, and on my chest a burning liquid which made me utter a howl of pain, and a dreadful noise, as if a sideboard laden with plates and dishes had fallen down, penetrated my ears. I felt myself suffocating under the weight that was crushing me and preventing me from moving. I stretched out my hand to find out what was the nature of this object. I felt a face, a nose, and whiskers. Then with all my strength I launched out a blow over this face. But I immediately received a hail of cuffings which made me jump straight out of the soaked sheets and rushed my nightshirt into the corridor, the door of which I found open. Oh, stupor! It was broad daylight. The noise brought my friends hurrying into the apartment, and we found, sprawling over my improvised bed, the dismayed valet, who, while bringing me my morning cup of tea, had tripped over the obstacle in the middle of the floor and fallen on his stomach, spilling, in spite of himself, my breakfast over my face. The precautions I had taken in closing the shutters and going to sleep in the middle of the room had only brought about the interlude I had been striving to avoid. Ah, how they all laughed that day! Recording by Lucy Perry, in Bath, on April 16th, 2009.
Here's the story of the 1940 cars in a nutshell.
Best bets Buick.
See your nearest Buick dealer for complete details.
Truth is stranger than fiction. And this is the proof. This is Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Robert
J. Ingersoll, famed 19th century attorney, charged as his fee for appearing in court $1,000 an hour. Believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about a siege that ended in romance.
Okay, we got a little bit of a break here. Be right back.
In the long and exciting history of England's Oliver Cromwell, there is an episode of love and military strategy. Marie O'Brien, the beautiful redhead whose husband was killed fighting Cromwell, agreed to surrender her castle of Lemonoff, Ireland, to Cromwell's besieging armies on one condition, that Cromwell order one of his officers to marry her. A Colonel John Cooper volunteered, and they lived happily ever after. Believe it or not.
Did you miss out on that big football game last week? Can't get rid of that head cold? Want to get away from it all?
CBS offers you Escape.
You're listening to Escape for October the 15th of 1947.
You are groping your way slowly through the dark hold of a ship at sea, moving carefully step by step, searching intently for something you dread to find, because you know that this ship carries a cargo of death.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations presents Escape, produced and directed by William N. Robeson, and carefully plotted to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Tonight we escape to a harbor front in Venezuela, and a grim voyage that started there, as told by Martin Storm in his gripping story, A Shipment of Mute Fate.
I stopped on the wharf at La Guayra, looked up the gangplank toward the liner Chan Kay, standing quietly there at her moorings. The day was warm under a bright tropic sun, and the harbor beyond the ship lay drowsy and silent. But all at once, in the midst of these peaceful surroundings, a cold chill gripped me, and I shivered with sudden dread. Dread of the thing I was doing and was about to do. But too much had happened to turn back now. I'd gone too far to stop. So I set the box down on the edge of the wharf, placed it carefully so as to be in plain sight and within gunshot of the captain's bridge. And then I turned and started up the gangplank. I knew what I was going to do, but I couldn't forget that a certain pair of beady eyes were watching every move I made. Eyes that never blinked and never closed. Just watched and waited.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Why, it's Mr. Warner.
Hello, Mother Willis. How's the best-looking stewardess on the Seven Seas?
Well, I'm fine, Mr. Warner. I guess better run along now and get on with my chores.
Now, wait a minute. That's a fine greeting after 2 months.
Well, it's just that I'm so busy.
I don't believe a word of it. Sailing day's tomorrow. You're simply avoiding me, that's all.
Oh, no, really, I'm not.
And on the trip down from New York, you said I was your favorite passenger.
But I'm only...
Here, wait a minute. What's that you're carrying in your apron there?
Oh, it's nothing. Just supplies.
Supplies? Well, let's have a look, huh?
No, please.
What do you know? It's a cat.
It's Clara, Mr. Warner.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Bowman said I had to leave her ashore, and I just couldn't.
Well, who's Mr. Bowman?
The new chief steward.
Oh.
Clara's been aboard with me for 2 years. And I just can't leave her here in a foreign country, especially with her condition so delicate and all.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Well, I hope you get away with it.
You won't tell anyone?
Not a soul. As a matter of fact, if things don't work out right, we may both end up smuggling.
Most happy to have you on board on the trip down 2 months ago, Christopher. I'm very glad you're coming along with us on the run back to New York.
Thanks, Captain Wood. There is one thing, though. I'm having a little trouble with the customs men here, and I wondered if you might...
I can't do it, Christopher. I just cabled your father this morning. Told him I'd done it for you if I possibly could. He sent a request from New York, you know.
Yeah, I thought he would. I wired him from upriver last week.
I hate to refuse, but it's absolutely out of the question.
Well, Captain Wood, I'm afraid I don't follow you there.
Responsibility to the passengers, son. We'll have women and children aboard. On a liner, the safety of the passengers comes ahead of anything.
But with proper precautions...
Something might happen. I don't know what, but something might.
You've carried worse things.
There isn't anything worse. And any skipper afloat will bear me out. Now, Christopher, I simply can't take the chance, and that's final.
Final. Well, it wasn't final if I could do anything about it. I hadn't come down here to spend 2 months in that stinking backcountry and then be stopped on the edge of the wharf. 2 months of it. Heat, rain, insects, malaria. I'd gone clear in past the headwaters of the Orinoco, traveled through country where every step along the jungle trail might be the last one. Oh, Sanchez.
Si, Senor Warner.
You better start looking for a place to camp. It'll be dark in a little while.
Si, Senor. Very soon we turn to river. Camp on rocks by water. This very bad country.
This very bad country. You've been saying that for 10 days now. Very bad country.
Well, si, Senor Warner, this very bad country.
Yeah, we'll skip it. For all the luck we've had so far, it might as well be Central Park.
Central Park? I don't understand.
Well, never mind. If we don't find
hey,
some...
Hey, leave me alone!
Here, what's the matter? Quiet now. Sanchez, what's wrong?
They're in the path. See? Bushmaster.
Bushmaster. The deadliest snake in the world. Bushmaster. Its Latin name was Lachesis muta. Mute fate. It lay there in the center of the path. A 10-foot length of silent death. Coiled loosely in an undulant loop. Ready to strike violently at the least movement. Here was the one snake that would go after any animal that walked. Or any man. It lay there and watched us. Not moving. Not afraid. Ready for anything. The splotch of its colors stood out like some horrible, gaudy floor mat lying there on the brown background of the jungle, waiting for someone to step on it. Here was what I'd come 2,000 miles for, a bushmaster. Sanchez! I didn't want that snake killed.
He no kill, senor. He gone. Bushmaster very smart, very quick. Must always see bullet in time to dodge.
Well, anyway, he's gone, and the only one we've seen in 5 weeks.
Oh, we find the other. This very bad country.
Well, lay off that gun the next time. Don't shoot, you understand?
Why you say no shoot? You want Bushmaster.
Sure, but I want it alive.
Hombre sacristo. Senor Warner, you tell me you want Bushmaster, but you no say alive.
You're getting $200 for it.
For dead man, what is $200? Tomorrow we go back to Caracas.
I'll make it 500, Sanchez.
I catch water snake, rattlesnake, any other kind. But I no catch Bushmaster.
Sanchez, I'll give you $1,000.
We go back to Caracas.
Well, it cost me 1,500 American dollars. But 3 days later, Sanchez brought me the snake in a rubber bag. He was shaking so hard, I thought for a moment the thing had struck him.
One thing you make sure, Senor Warner. No turn him loose in Venezuela. Because he know I the one who catch him. And he know where I live.
All right, Sanchez, I'll keep an eye on him.
También he know you pay me to catch him. All the time he watch and wait. You no forget that, Senor Warner. Because he no forget. Not ever.
Well, after going through all that trouble and danger and laying out $1,500, I wasn't going to let a pig-headed ship captain stop me at the last minute. At least not as long as the cables were still in operation between La Guaira and New York. Morning, Captain Wood. The boy at the hotel said you wanted to see me.
That's right, Christopher. Sit down.
Thank you.
Seems you weren't willing to let matters stand the way we left them yesterday.
I'm sorry to go over your head, Captain Wood, but I had to. The museum sent me all the way down here for it. And I'm not going to be stopped by red tape. This will be the only live Bushmaster ever brought to the United States.
Mm. Yes, and if I had my way, but... well, orders are orders. I got a cable from the head office this morning. All right. I suppose we talk about precautions.
I'll handle it any way you say.
Got to have a stronger box. That crate's too flimsy.
Well, it's stronger than it looks. And that wire screen on top would hold a wildcat. But anyway, I bought a heavy sea chest this morning. I will put the crate inside of it.
Sounds all right. You got a lock on it?
Heavy padlock. It's fixed so that the lid can be propped open a crack without unlocking it. The snake's got to have air.
But in dirty weather, that lid stays shut. I'll take no chances.
Fair enough.
I will keep the thing in my inside cabin where I sleep. I can't have it in the baggage room. And nobody on board's to know about it.
Whatever you say, Captain. But we won't have any trouble. After all, it's only an animal. It doesn't have any magical powers.
I saw a bushmaster in the zoo at Caracas once. Had it in a glass cage with double walls. It'd never move. Just lay there. Look at you as long as you were in sight. Gave a man the creeps.
I didn't know they had a bushmaster at the Caracas Zoo.
They don't. Now. Found the glass broken one morning, the snake gone. Night watchman was dead. They never found out what happened.
Well, the watchman must have broken the glass by accident some way.
The way they figured it, the glass was broken from the inside. Well, we sail in 4 hours.
We steam north into the Caribbean with perfect weather and a sea as smooth as an inland lake. The barometer dropped a little on the third day, but cleared up overnight and left nothing worse than a heavy swell. But in spite of the calm seas and the pleasant weather, I found myself feeling more and more often an ominous foreboding. I was developing an almost unnatural fear of that snake. Well, I stayed clear of the passengers pretty much. Got the habit of dropping into Captain Wood's quarters several times a day. He kept the heavy box underneath his berth. I'd approach it quietly and shine my flashlight through the open crack. Never once could I catch that 12-foot devil asleep, or even excited. He'd be lying there, half-coiled, his head raised a little, staring out of those beady black eyes, waiting. He'd still be like that when I'd turn away to leave. Maybe that's what bothered me, that horrible and constant watchful waiting. What in the name of heaven was he waiting for?
Well, hello there, Mr. Warner.
Oh, how are you, Mother Willis?
My, but you and the captain spend an awful lot of time around this cabin. I'm beginning to think the two of you must have some guilty secret.
Oh, no, nothing like that, Mother Willis. I don't know about Captain Wood, but I... Well, I certainly don't have any guilty secret.
Well, she's running quite a swell out there, Mr. Bowman.
Yeah, it's a little heavy, all right, Mr. Warner. Guess a storm passed through to the west of us yesterday when the glass dropped.
Think it missed us then, huh?
Yeah, that's what the mate figures. Sure stirred up some water, though.
This'll put half the passengers in their bunks.
Makes it great for my department. Two-thirds of them will want a steward to hold their heads.
They'll keep Mother Willis so busy she'll have... Wait, look at the size of that wave.
Huh? The great Jehoshaphat. We're going to take it on the port bow. Hang on!
Well, that was a freak if there ever was one. Not another wave in sight.
You see him like that sometimes, even in a calm sea. Well, I got to get below, Mr. Warner. That water probably did some damage on the officer's deck.
Yeah, I suppose it... What did you say?
The wheel companionway was open on the port side. Bridge cabins must have taken a pretty bad smashing up. They're right below the, Here, is something wrong, Mr. Warner?
No, nothing at all, Mr. Warner. At least I hope not. I looked first for Captain Wood and couldn't find him. Of course, I knew it was only one chance in 1,000, but the chances against that freak wave were 1 in 1,000, too. Well, I couldn't waste any more time, so I stumbled down the companionway and along the passage to the captain's cabin.
Oh, come on in, Mr. Warner.
Brother Willis.
My, isn't this cabin a mess? Trying to get some of these things out to dry.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to check. Where's that box that was under the captain's bunk?
Threw it out on that.
But where? We didn't know. It was nearly dark when we met together again in the charge room.
I don't get the thing
at all. There's no other way around it. We've risked all the time we can. We've got to warn the passengers.
Well, how do we do it, Captain? Call them all together in the lounge?
No, if we did anything like that, we'd be asking for a panic.
We'll get one, whether we ask for it or not.
Pick a few men and go through the cabin decks. Tell them individually, inside their cabins. Watch for any act that looks as though it might cause trouble. And we'll keep an eye on them. Handle the crew the same way.
Right, Captain. Okay. We'll
take care. As soon as you've finished, arm all the deck officers and start searching again. Our only chance of preventing a riot is to find that damnable snake.
The slow nightmare that followed grew worse by the hour. None of us slept. All the ship's officers not on duty kept on with that endless search. Passengers locked themselves in their cabins or huddled together in the lounges, knowing all the time that no spot on board could be called safe. Fear was a heavy fog in the lungs of all of us, and every light on the vessel burned throughout the night. Morning came and brought no relief. Terror and tension mounted by the hour.
Now, Mrs. Crane, stop getting yourself all worked up and go back to your cabin. The horrid thing's probably crawled overboard anyway.
You're just saying that. You're paid to say it. You don't know. Nobody does.
Now, everything's going to be all right.
Oh, if you could only do something. If all of us could only get off the ship. They could fumigate it. Yes, that's what we've got to do. We've got to get off the ship.
Now, wait. Mr. Bowman. Mr. Bowman, she's going to jump.
No, you don't, lady.
Let me go. Let me go!
Oh, nice work.
Let me go!
Nice work, Mr. Bowman.
Let me go.
Get her down to her cabin. Whatever you do, don't turn her loose.
Well, you never know when it might strike you. You can't put on a coat or move a chair without risking your life. Now, something's got to be done.
Yes,
it might be right here in this lounge.
All right, Miss Steve. You better quiet down. Take it easy.
Take it easy, huh? Well, you're a great officer. Why don't you do something about it? That thing might be crawling around here right under our feet somewhere.
Like I said, shut up. Are you trying to start a panic?
I got a right to talk. I don't want to die. Nobody's
okay.
Going to tell me.
The second night passed, and morning came around again. A gray and rainy day, just as grim and tense, dragged past, and the night came down again. Third night of the terror. Again, every light burned, and the whole ship seethed in the throes of incipient panic. Faced by a horror they'd never met on the sea before, crew and officers alike were on the verge of revolt. Passengers sat huddled in a trance-like stupor, ready to scream at the slightest unknown sound. At seven bells, I made my way forward to the chart room and found Captain Wood bent over a desk.
Hello, Christopher. Come on in. Sit down.
Well, it's got to be somewhere, Captain Wood. It's got to be.
I don't know. You could search this ship for 6 months and never touch all the places aboard. If we can only hold out for 2 more days, we'll be in.
Well, what's the Home Office say?
Oh, here's the latest wireless from them. Keep quiet and keep coming. What else can we do? How is it on the decks?
Pretty bad. Anything could happen.
Yeah. That's why I took the guns away from the men. One pistol shot and we'd have a riot on our hands.
Oh, the whole thing's my fault, Captain Wood. That's what I can't forget.
Oh, take it easy, man.
There's only some way I could pay for it myself, alone.
No, I know how you feel, but it's no more your fault than mine, or the man who asked you to bring the snake back alive. Nobody planned this. You'd better try and get a little sleep.
Sleep?
Mr. Bowman made some coffee down the steward's galley a while ago. You better go down, get yourself a cup, and then rest up for a couple of hours.
Rest? I can't rest.
Christopher, it's no good going. What are you going to do? You can't help anything. You'd be stumbled through a hatch, half asleep, and break your neck. Go on and get some coffee. One way or another, we've got to hold out for two more days.
The light was on in the steward's galley, and the coffee pot was standing on the stove. It was still warm, so I didn't bother to heat it. I poured out a cup, carried it over, and set it on the porcelain tabletop in the center of the room. I started to light a cigarette. The door of the pan cupboard beneath the sink was standing slightly ajar, and I happened to glance down toward it. Out from the dark interior of the cupboard shone two glittering points of light 2 inches apart. I dropped the cigarette and moved slowly backward. I'd found the Bushmaster. As I moved, the snake slid out of the cupboard in a single sinuous glide and drew back into a loose coil on the galley floor, never taking his eyes off me. I moved slowly back, waiting any moment for that deadly slithering strike. How had he known it was me? He'd stayed quiet when Bowman was here. How did he know to pick the first time in 3 days when I didn't have a gun? Well, my hands touched the wall behind me and I stopped. Only then I realized in terror what I'd done. The call button and the door were on the far side of the room. I'd backed into a dead end. I stared at the snake in fascination, expecting any moment the ripping slash of those poison fangs. The horrid coils tightened a little and then were still again. 10 million years of evolution to produce this moment. Homo sapiens versus Lachesis muta. Man against mute fate. And all the odds were on fate. I knew then that I was going to die. I could feel the sweat run down between the painted wall and the palms of my hands pressed against it. My skin crawled and twitched. And the pit of my stomach was as cold as ice. There was no sound but the rush of blood in my ears. The snake shifted again, drawing into a tighter coil. Always tighter. Why the devil didn't he get it over with? And then, for just an instant, his head veered away. Something moved over by the stove. I didn't dare turn to look at it. Slowly, it moved out into my line of vision. It was a cat. That scrawny cat, Clara, that Mother Willis had sneaked aboard in La Guaira. Its back was arched, and every hair stood on end. It moved stiff-legged now, walking in a half-circle around the snake. The Bushmaster shifted slowly and kept watching the cat. He tightened. He was going to strike at any second. He struck and missed. The cat was barely out of reach. Now she was walking back and forth again. She was asking to die. Missed again by a fraction of an inch. He was striking now without even going to a full coil. Missed. Again and again, always missing by the barest margin. Each time the cat danced barely out of reach, and each time she countered with one precise spat of a dainty paw, bracing her skinny frame on three stiff legs. And then suddenly I realized what she was doing. The Bushmaster was tiring, and one strike was just an instant slow. But in that split second, sharp claws raked across the evil head and ripped out both of the lidless eyes. That cat had deliberately blinded the snake. Well, he didn't bother to coil now, but slid after in a fury, striking wildly and rapidly, always missing, and every strike was a little slower than the last one. Until finally, as the snake's neck stretched out at the end of a strike, the cat made one leap and sank her razor-sharp teeth just back of the ugly head, sank them in until they crunched bone. With tooth and claw, she clung as the monster snake flailed and lashed on the floor, striving to get those hideous coils around her, trying to break her hold, to shake off the slow and certain paralyzing death that gradually crept over him and at last stilled his struggles forever. I took a deep breath. The first in minutes. The cat lay on her side on the floor, panting, resting from the fight just over. And she had a right to rest. That mangy, brave, beautiful alley cat had just saved my life. And maybe others as well. But as I turned toward the stove, I suddenly became very humble, and I knew all at once what a small thing a human being really is. I and others aboard were still alive only by the merest accident. There were three reasons why that cat had fought and killed the world's deadliest snake, And those three reasons came tottering out from under the stove on shaky little legs. Three kittens, with their eyes bright with wonder and their tails stiff as pokers. Up on the decks, hundreds of passengers were waiting for the news that the days and nights of terror were ended. Well, I could wait a little longer. I pulled open the doors of the cabinet, found a can of milk. And then I dropped down on my knees on the floor of the galley.
Escape is produced and directed by William N. Robeson, and tonight brought you A Shipment of Mute Fate by Martin Storm, adapted for radio by Les Crutchfield, with Jack Webb as Chris Warner, Raymond Lawrence as Captain Wood, and D.J. Thompson as Mother Willis. The special musical score was conceived and conducted by Cy Feuer.
Strange Adventure. Captain Von Schuyler sat in his chair in the shade of the tree and surveyed the ragged African before him. The Germans had driven most of the natives out of the rich territory that had been their home for centuries. Now the few that still lived here were about to face the ordeal of crossing the burning expanse of the Kalahari Desert to seek a new home. The native bowed slightly before the German officer.
I have a message for you from my chief.
The officer stirred slightly in his chair and regarded the old man with contempt.
What message, Feinhut? Speak quickly and get out. It's time for my nap.
My chief bids me tell you that since our land is no longer ours, our tribe must leave. The only well this side of desert is here in your camp. We wish to fill our water vessels, for many days must pass before we reach water.
No! Does your pig of a chief think I am in this accursed country to provide him and his people with water? Get out! Get your water in the Kalahari!
The native listened with an impassive face to the captain's words. Then he looked straight into the face of the German. The old man raised his hand and pointed toward the border of the Kalahari as he spoke.
You who are sending us to our death will die in the desert, not by lack of water, but by it.
The officer rose and, in a sudden, impassioned rage, struck the native across the face with his riding crop. The old man did not flinch from the insulting blow, but pointed his hand at his attacker.
You shall die. By water in the desert, you shall die. I pronounce against you the curse of the Kalahari.
A week later, Captain Von Schuyler received orders to take a scouting party into the desert. The Germans, led by native guides, set out upon the long, hard march. On the third day, the last known water hole had been passed, and the trip across the wilderness was beginning to tell upon both men and horses. On they went, until at last the party entered a small canyon. Nestled in the bottom of the rocky defile were two clear pools of water. Von Schuyler called a halt.
You men, dismount here. You will drink and water your horses at the larger pool. I am going to have a nice bath in this one.
He removed his uniform and waded into the water. The weary soldiers drank their fill, watered their horses, then sat back to enjoy the shade of the surrounding boulders. Suddenly, a strangled cry brought them to their feet. The men ran toward the smaller pool. Von Schuyler stood in the center, his arms thrashing madly. Before the men realized what had happened, the officer sank to his chin, and another wild scream burst from his lips. Suddenly, the plight of their leader became clear. Quicksand! There was a short struggle, and Von Schuyler disappeared, dying as the old witch doctor had prophesied, by water in the desert, by the dread curse of the Kalahari. This is Pat McGeehan in Hollywood, California, saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to tune in again to another tale of Strange Adventure.
Coupon number 17, ration coupon 17. Are you planning to use your shoe ration coupon to buy white shoes? If so, give them the best of care. Keep them clean with Energene Shoe White. No shoe white can make your shoes look whiter than Energene Shoe White. It's made with the very whitest pigment known, and it spreads so easily, dries so evenly, it gives your shoes the neat, well-kept look they must have to give you the most satisfactory wear. For the best of care for the white shoes you wear, remember Energene Shoe White. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
We got a break. But we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. And I hope you like science fiction. I sure do. Coming next is an episode of Escape that originally aired on October the 19th of 1961. And before we get into it, I do want to take a moment to sort of warn you off a little bit. Maybe I shouldn't do that, but I kind of think I should. The sound quality on this show is not terrific. Oh, I've played shows that have noticeably worse sound quality. This particular episode of Suspense is known to the world as The Black Door, and has been called by critics a story that is as engrossing as it is absurd. And actually, believe it or not, it's about a lost city in the jungle that was once inhabited by, well, I'll tell you what, you'll see. And I think you'll have to agree it's absurd, but in spite of that, I feel it's representative of old-time radio, and in the way that it handled science fiction throughout the 40s and 50s and into the 60s. Now, I could sit here and make all kinds of excuses for it, and excuses for why I played it. But the fact is, I just think it's fun, and I think you will too. Just put your mind in neutral and settle back and go along for the ride. I did. And it was worth the trip.
And now, a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense. Listen now to Act One of The Black Door, starring Robert Reddick, featuring Ralph Camargo, and written especially for Suspense by Robert Arthur. I made was going through that black door. If I'd left it shut the way it was, sealed tight, everything would have been fine. I'd have married Marcia, become a full professor, had my name in all the papers. Well, there's no use telling the story backwards, is there? First things first, as old Professor Wentworth always said. And the first thing in this case is the grant I received for a lost city in Central America. The city of the fire god. Which might mean something, or might mean nothing. Anyway, I got the grant from the university, chartered a modern helicopter for 3 months, flew it down to Central America, got the necessary government permissions, and made my base of operations the tiny little town of San Marcos on the coast. As nearly as I could figure from the manuscript, the city of the fire god was someplace among the mountains in that area. So I flew back and forth over the mountains in a helicopter, keeping a lookout for rooms in the jungle or the mountain valleys. For 2.5 months, I saw nothing except trees and rocks. In the town, I was charitably looked upon as a crazy yonkee. And finally, even the children stopped staring at me. But I was getting pretty discouraged. Trying to forget my troubles in a glass of tequila in a little garden outside the town's only cafe, while some native with a guitar serenaded his girl nearby.
Waiter? Wait. Oh, there you are.
Pardon, senor. I am not the waiter. He's busy.
Busy? No one's been busy in this town since Columbus discovered America.
That's very true, senor, but... I have paid the waiter to go somewhere else. That's why he's busy. look at this, senor.
Well, let me see that. What
tiny statue, very old. Huh? A statue carved out of volcanic basalt in the style of the oldest known Mayan carving. Where did you get that?
Oh, that is easily answered, senor.
Well, then tell me.
My grandfather, he gave it to me when he died.
Well, where did he get it?
Senor, that is a harder question.
Now, look, if you came here just to play games with me...
No, senor, no. That is why I sent away the waiter. So we could talk confidentially.
Yes, well, let's talk confidentially. Where did that little statue come from?
From the mountains, senor.
Well, the whole country is mountains.
See, that is true, but... My grandfather was a great hunter. Once he followed a wounded jaguar high into the mountains. Mm. Some savage natives then followed my grandfather.
Yes?
He was wounded, and to escape, he climbed a great cliff.
Go on.
And he reached the top. And on the other side, he saw a dead city.
A dead city?
Si, senor. Silent. Lifeless. Far below him.
Yes?
He tried to climb down to it. And he fell, senor. For 3 days he lay unconscious. And when he recovered his senses, he had the fever.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow he found his way out. He does not know how. He staggered back to his home. They found him in the jungle, crawling on his hands and knees, clutching this little statue and saying over and over, La Puerta Negra! La Puerta Negra!
What?
The black door, senor.
A black door?
Si, senor. And my poor grandfather, he was never strong enough to go hunting again, but he kept this little statue. And he said it had saved his life.
What did he mean by the black door?
Oh, one cannot say, senor. He could not remember.
Surely he went back to the lost city?
Well, no, he was not strong enough. Besides, there were the savages.
But you mean nobody ever tried to find the city again?
Well, why should they, senor? It belonged to the dead. Well, they might be angry if the living came to disturb them.
That was old superstition.
Si, senor. Now, me, I am not superstitious, eh? I speak American well. The senor wishes to find this lost city. I, Pedro Ramirez, know where it is.
Go on.
You see, my grandfather described it to me. The mountains where it is hidden. Mm-hmm. They are 3 days walk from here.
Well, 3 days, now that's 50 or 60 miles. What direction?
senor, that is the question, eh? What direction? A most important question, no?
I get it. How much?
A mere pittance for a rich yankee, senor. $1,000 American.
$1,000?
And one half of all the treasure.
What treasure is that?
Oh, there must be treasure, senor. Why else would you seek this lost city?
Because I want to become a professor at a university and marry a girl named Marcia, whose father is head of the Department of Archaeology. All right. $1,000 if you actually guide me to the city you say your grandfather found.
And half the treasure.
Yes. Half the treasure. If any. We sealed the bargain with a glass of tequila. And the next day, Pedro came with me in the helicopter. He directed me to fly to the southeast, and I did, hovering as low as I dared over the rocky edges and jungle.
We've come more than 50 miles, Pedro. No sign of that city yet.
Oh, yes, senor. There to the left. That is the mountain.
That? Now, you're crazy. That's the cone of an extinct volcano.
Si, senor. And the lost city is inside the volcano.
Oh, now, wait a minute. How could that be?
Well, I do not know. I was not there when it was built.
On the other hand, city of the fire god. I wonder... Well, I haven't looked into that volcano yet, so here goes.
We lifted high in the air over the top of the old dead volcano. And we came out over a deep circular valley, grown up with jungle now. But there, in the center of the jungle, was a group of stone buildings dominated by a vast ruined temple.
Senor! Senor! The lost city of my grandfather! Oh, it is rich with treasure! I have the feeling!
But even if it isn't, this is one of the biggest finds in the history of Central America. We're going down now. We'll sit down on that level spot right in front of the temple.
We settled in front of the old temple.
I cut the motors. And for a moment, we just sat there taking it in. Stone towers. The ancient carvings. The massive walls that had been put into place by men whose bones had turned to dust maybe 3,000-4,000 years ago. And then we climbed out. We were both armed. We had flashlights. And I had a small hammer and chisel tucked into my belt. Aboard the helicopter, I had a case of dynamite if any blasting was necessary, but this was just to be a preliminary survey, so I left it where it was. Pedro and I found ourselves on a big stone plaza with a partially ruined temple in front of us. The entrance was flanked by two tremendous stone carvings. Oddly enough, very like something from Egypt. Human figures with heads that were vaguely dog-like, which made them seem most unhuman.
Senor, those statues, I do not like them.
Yes, they are rather odd. But I'm more interested in those designs carved in the rock above them.
Huh? Designs, senor? Oh, they but show the moon, the new moon and the old moon.
Yes, and there are more moons all over the front of the temple. Now, that's unusual. Most of the old civilizations in this area worship the sun.
Si, senor, but I cannot help wondering.
Wondering what?
Why the man who made those statues put the heads of dogs on them.
It was dark inside the temple. But our flashlights gave us enough light. Vast stone pillars supported a roof high above us as we moved down a lengthy corridor. And then we came into a central rotunda and got some sunlight through a crack in the roof.
Look! Look, senor! Gold! Gold! 10 statues! 12 statues! And each of them solid gold! Come, look, senor! Gold! Gold! I have reached!
Abel was right. Ranged in a circle in the middle of the rotunda were 12 golden statues about 5 feet high. They were all human figures with dog-like heads. And they were all looking at a spot on the floor in the middle of the circle they made.
Gold, senor! Look, the jewels! Baskets of the
moon,
senor! Senor, I am the richest man in the world!
At the foot of each statue, a carved stone basket. Each one has a handful of gems in it. Obviously, these statues were worshipped. The gems were tribute.
Pedro, have you taken a good look at these statues? Shine your light on this one.
Madre mia! Again, the head of the dog.
Yes, they're all dog-headed statues. And all their eyes are focused on one spot over there. Seems to be something carved on the floor. Let's see what that is.
Ah, senor. That is more strange.
A round black carving on the floor. Almost like a globe or a map.
Good Lord. Do you know what this is supposed to be?
No, senor, I cannot guess. It's the moon. Carved on the floor in black basalt, the moon.
Ah, see. Oh, that is most strange, no?
You don't know the half of it, because the formations carved here, they're not the formations our astronomers know, unless the Russians have some new pictures they're not talking about. If this carving represents the real geography of the moon... Pedro?
Yes, senor?
The artist who carved this must at some time have seen the dark side of the moon, which no human being has ever glimpsed. I know it sounds crazy, but the more I studied that round black carving, The more I was convinced it was an accurate relief map of the dark side of the moon. And then we discovered something else. Around the rim of that black disk was a series of crevices filled with tar. I dug the tar out, and under it, in each crevice, we found a small basalt statuette like the one that Pedro had originally shown. In each crevice but one, which was empty.
Senor, see? The story of my grandfather is true. This little statue he brought back, look! It just fits into this tiny hole.
Yes, yes, it does. Yeah. Black door. This must be the black door that he talked about.
Oh, si, senor. La puerta negra. The black door. But how does it open?
I don't know. Now, wait, wait. Suppose we stand each of these little statues upright. Yes. Yes, they fit tightly like handles. Now, if we push them...
Si, senor, we push.
And
it's turning. The black disc is turning. And now it's loose. Now we can lift it up. Let us lift it. Down there, maybe more treasure, eh? More gold, more tools.
All right. Now, it's coming.
See?
There, it's open. And there's a well-worn flight of steps leading down to the heart of the old volcano. I stood there, staring down to that black passageway that seemed to go down, down endlessly. I didn't like the looks of it. The Pedro had gold fever. He thought that there might be whole vaults of treasure down below. I couldn't talk him out of looking, so I went along too. The tunnel sloped downward, ever downward to the heart of the ancient volcano. We came across evidence of much usage, broken pottery, strange carvings on the wall. Our curiosity led us on until presently we came to a cavern whose walls seemed to be lined by a curious growth.
Senor, look!
Yes, yes, mushrooms, or something very much like mushrooms, solid sheets of it all lining the wall.
No, senor, that is not what I mean. Look here. Look through here.
Oh, a narrow crevice. There's a room in there.
It's not a room. It is what is in the room. Come, shine your light.
Then let us leave.
Senor,
what has got you so worked up? It can't be treasure. I see.
See? The skeletons, senor. Many skeletons. Hundreds, men. Lying one upon the other.
Yes, yes. That rocky room is full of human bones. As much as I hate to say it.
What, senor?
The ones I can see best have tooth marks on them.
Oh, senor, let us leave here swiftly. Let us return to the airplane, eh? Let us take the treasure and go.
Easy now, Pedro. These bones have been here hundreds of years, maybe thousands.
Old bones or no bones, I do not like these bones.
No cause for alarm. I don't know.
Why does the senor study so hard the mushrooms on the wall?
These mushrooms certainly haven't been here for 1,000 years, and along here it looks to me as if big handfuls have been broken off.
Broken off? What, why?
There's only one thing I know of you can do with mushrooms, and that's eat them. Pedro and I stood staring at each other. I was pretty sure that something, or somebody, had recently been eating that mushroom-like fungus. And I was beginning to wonder what or who when we heard it from somewhere far down below us.
Senor, what's that?
Sounded like a dog howling.
A dog? No. That is no dog.
Well, what if it's not a dog? What is it?
A demon, senor. A devil.
Oh, forget that superstition. There's something down there, impossible as it seems, something living.
And if we do not leave, there will be something dying down here, senor. Please come.
Yes, but I'm trying to figure out what on earth I could...
Senor Langridge. Those are not dogs upstairs. These statues, the people with heads of dogs upon them. Does the senor not realize where it is that is howling?
Until that second, I hadn't made the connection. And then I realized the full significance of those statues. It couldn't be. It was impossible. But what other answer was there? We turned to head to the surface, and just as we did so, I saw something coming up the tunnel toward us. Something that was a pallid white shape in the light of my flashlight. Something running on all fours and howling hungrily at the distance.
Shoot, senor, shoot!
Okay, that stopped it.
Now, let's get out of here.
We didn't even stop to look at what I'd shot. I'm not sure I wanted to look. We just turned and ran up that long tunnel to the surface. And as we went, the howling things pursued us. We could hear them behind us like a pack of hungry animals. From time to time, I turned to fire my gun. But I seem to share them. We finally popped out into that ruined temple with the 12 dog-headed gods, and I understood at last what that black door was for. It sealed the entrance to the underground world where they lived. Pedro and I flung ourselves on the ground.
A great round slab of black rock was, and we couldn't move it. It was wedged open somehow, and we couldn't get it closed. Senor, quickly! They will follow us in a moment!
Gathered down there beyond the first bend. Obviously, they don't like light.
They are getting up there. Hurry!
Oh, we've got to shut them in. We can't let those things loose.
We can't shut the black door.
We can do nothing.
The helicopter, quickly.
I got it. The dynamite, my helicopter. We'll blow in the mouth of the tunnel.
But, Senor,
you heard me. It'll only take 60 seconds. Yeah, that'll keep them quiet another minute or two. Now, come on, help me with that case of dynamite.
It took us less than a minute to get the case of dynamite, bring it back inside the temple and light a fuse.
And then I shoved the whole case down the steps into the black tunnel.
Pedro and I hurried back into the open, scrambled into the helicopter, and started the motor just in case.
Ah, Senor Landry.
What is it?
The treasure. The jewels. We did not bring them.
We can get them after the tunnel is blown in. You don't want to tangle with those dog-headed creatures, do you?
No, por los santos, no. But, Senor, what are they? They must be demons, for surely they are not of this world.
Well, I agree with you, but they're not demons.
That does it. The tunnel is closed for good. Now,
Senor, the temple is collapsing. And the earth is shaking. Senor, it's an earthquake.
Pedro, there's only one place for us to go, and that's straight up. The helicopter jumped 1,000 feet straight up, just before the temple crashed from the spot where we had been. And then we watched from a box seat while the lost city crumbled into ruins. The dynamite blast had triggered off an earthquake, and the earthquake rocked the ground like a man shaking a baby's rattle.
Senor, the jewels, the gold, they are down there under many rocks.
Yes, and so are the dog-headed creatures. Suppose they'd got loose on the world after being caged underground for thousands of years.
Oh, I can only think of all that treasure. For a little while, I was the richest man in the world. I owned a lost city full of jewels. Now I own nothing.
After things quiet down, I can bring back an expedition. We'll dig in the ruins. The jewels will still be there.
You see? That is true, no? I will be rich yet, no? I will buy myself 3 automobiles and 12 silk shirts. I will smoke cigars all day long and have servants to do everything. Senor, I am ruined. I am ruined.
What is it now?
The dead volcano. He's coming to life. See, the smoke is coming from the ground. Senor, fly higher. We are doomed.
Dynamite triggered an earthquake, and the earthquake opened up fissures leading far down to where the volcanic fires had been banked for thousands of years. And by the time we got 10 miles away, that entire mountain was blowing up in a vast, spouting fire and ashes and molten rock. But somewhere down in the heart of that inferno was the lost city. City of the Fire God. It would have made my reputation. Enough treasure to pay off the national debt. And a howling mob of creatures you wouldn't want to meet this side of hell. Well, that's the story. You read about the new volcano. Now you know what caused it. Would you like to know my theory about those creatures? Well, it's this. 6 or 7,000 years ago, this old earth had some visitors, refugees, you might call them. Some of them settled in Egypt, some in Central America. They brought some highly scientific skills with them, including the secret of overcoming gravity. They ruled for a while, worshipped as gods, and then died out. All except a few who found inside an old volcano a spot just about like home. The native priests managed to lock them in behind that black door that kept them prisoners.
After the natives died out, the dog people existed underground, living on mushrooms and keeping their race alive on an animal level. Now they're gone. But here's a tip for the Army and the Air Force. When you land your first missiles on the moon, keep your eyes open and your guns ready. Because inside those tremendous craters of the moon, living far underground where, maybe, there's still warmth and air, I have a hunch you're going to be running into people. Moon people. Who look a lot like us. Except for their heads. Black Door, starring Robert Reddick, featuring Ralph Camargo, and written especially for Suspense by Robert Arthur. Suspense is produced and directed by Bruno Zerato Jr. Music supervision by Ethel Huber. Suspense.
Believe it or not.
Yes, believe it or not. Fascinating pages from the amazing radio sketchbook of that dynamic discoverer of detailed, isifying data, Bob Ripley. And here to tell us more about it is the Dean of Newsreel Commentators, Gregory Abbott.
Hello, Bill Griffiths, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Bob Ripley's Believe It or Not Radio Auditorium. A little later in the program, Bob will report to us by shortwave from Honolulu. And while our engineers are contacting Bob, we're going to present a special Hawaiian Believe It or Not drama from the radio sketchbook.
And what's it about today?
It concerns a true incident from Hawaiian history that is one of the most fantastic freaks of fate ever recorded. Stay tuned and you'll hear it in exactly 60 seconds.
During this week, the president will proclaim I Am an American Day, honoring all those who this year have become new citizens of the United States. These new citizens will dedicate themselves to the upholding of our freedom. But it is not only on this one day that they and all the rest of us should proudly proclaim that we are Americans. Every day should find us doing what we can to uphold the tradition of liberty for which our country stands. Well, that means that we must be active citizens. For only if we work at being Americans can we retain the heritage we hold. Not by leaving the governing of our communities up to the other fellows and the politicians. Not by dodging our work on school boards and jury panels. And not by passing up the international news in the paper to find out how the local pitcher did yesterday. Tyrannies feed on laziness. And it's time we made every day the day to say, I am an American. And now back to Bob Ripley's Radio Auditorium.
Bob Ripley's Believe It or Not dramatic sketch today takes place on the island of Hawaii back in the year 1790. The old king had died and his kingdom passed into the hands of his nephew, Kamehameha. Another nephew, Keoua, retired in disgust to the southwestern side of the island. There he managed to extract tribute from several disgruntled war chiefs by pledging that he would claim the kingdom of Kamehameha and divide its rich land among them. Keoua lived in luxury, but made no attempt to keep his pledge. The rebel chiefs grew impatient. And now the most powerful of them, Hekili, the Thunderer, has come to speak with Keoua.
Welcome, Chief Hekili.
May Pele smile on you, Your Majesty.
I am honored by your visit.
I come to speak of matters of state, Your Majesty. I trust you will listen.
Have I ever turned a deaf ear to my greatest chieftain? Speak, Hekili.
Your Majesty must be aware that 3 years have passed since we chieftains of Kau first pledged allegiance to you.
Is it so? Well, 3 years is a long time, Hekili.
A very long time. The time is auspicious for attack now, Your Majesty.
Oh, no. My high priest tells me that the goddess Pele is not favorable to a war against my cousin.
Your high priest tells you what he knows your ears wish to hear.
Are you suggesting that he is corrupt?
As corrupt as my own high priest, he tells me exactly what he knows I desire him to tell me.
I see, Hekili. I have always been a reasonable man. What do you suggest?
Just this. That before another moon has passed, you march upon Kamehameha. We will take him by surprise and sweep across his lands like fire.
What makes you think we could take him by surprise?
Soon he sends most of his men to make war on the island of Maui.
Ah, Akili. As you know, I have always been first a warrior and second a king. Despite the tremendous odds confronting us, I consent to lead our armies into battle.
I knew your bravery would force you to agree with us, Your Highness.
Yes, make offerings to Pele, the volcano goddess, that she may look with favor on our venture. Ready our armies. I swear before six moons have passed, we march upon Kamehameha.
Yeah, you got it. This is a break. And we'll be back real soon.
And the drums of war were heard again on the island of Hawaii. All that night, the soldiers of Kaua made their way across Hawaii toward the kingdom of the unsuspecting Kamehameha. Suddenly, however, as they approached the great volcano Kilauea on the edge of Kamehameha's land, the volcano began to mutter angrily. Kaua called to Chief Hekili.
Hekili! The volcano god speaks. This bodes no good for our armies.
The face assure Pele is favorable.
You yourself told me the priests are bought and sold like cattle.
We cannot turn back now.
The men grow resty. We cannot expect them to fight well if they are frightened.
To turn back would be disastrous.
That is a trouble with you soldiers. Everything must be done with a show of bravery. It is not good. Halt the column.
Soldiers, halt! Well, what do you suggest?
That there are more ways than one to snare the fox, Hekili. Listen, I will go ahead alone to the palace of my cousin, Kamehameha.
Alone?
As a friend, I will tell him I wish to renew our friendship.
And then?
You will poise our army here at the foot of Kilauea.
Ah.
I will again gain Kamehameha's confidence and suggest that we go to the volcano to offer a sacrifice for the blessings of Pele, as is the custom.
What will we gain?
Do you not see? I lead him here. I show him our great army, poised to leap on his kingdom. I demand that he yield or be destroyed.
And if he yield not?
Kamehameha is no fool. He values his own life too much. He will yield, and we will win the battle without losing a man.
Say no more. I will order the army to parade here in full battle dress that he may think we are truly invincible.
I am most happy that my cousin wishes to restore our friendship. Oh, listen. Pele rumbles angrily. Perhaps we should wait until tomorrow to make our sacrifice.
Nonsense. If Pele is angry, a sacrifice should quiet him. It is not much further now.
Someone must have committed a great sin to anger Pele thus. The smoke thickens. Let's turn back and make our sacrifice another time.
And risk our newfound friendship unprotected by the gods? No, only a few more steps, cousin, and we shall come to the place of sacrifice.
Let it be done quickly. My eyes are burning from the vapors of the volcano.
So did my soul burn with outrage when our uncle left you his kingdom and left me nothing.
What?
Look. Look, there in the clearing. The most powerful armies in Hawaii.
You joke.
I do not joke, Kamehameha. Surely you do not really think I came to offer you friendship?
What?
If so, you are a greater fool than even I suspected.
You
do not draw your sword or I will call my soldiers.
God, there. You have betrayed me.
My soldiers, thousands of them, look at them. Look at them.
They stand as if paralyzed.
They're well disciplined, Kamehameha. They wait for the command to advance. Oh, Hekili! Chief Hekili! Hekili! Why do you not move? Why do you stare? Hekili!
It is useless to call your chief, Keua.
Useless?
Yes, Keua. Pele has punished you. Not one of your soldiers will ever take a single step again. Every man in your army is stone dead.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, King Kamehameha was right. Every single soldier in Keua's army was dead. Each man had been killed instantly by some mysterious power, paralyzed as they stood, like carved statues. Some say that the men were paralyzed by a blast of sulfurous gas. Others say that they were stricken by a blast of heated steam. But the superstitious natives of Hawaii ascribe it to the fact that Keua incurred the wrath of the volcano god Pele by his treachery. The bodies were never buried, and to this day the bones of Keua's army lie bleaching in the sun. Believe it or not.
In just a moment, we'll hear by shortwave from Bob Ripley in Honolulu, Hawaii, scene of today's dramatic sketch. But first, here's a man with a message.
In the past 40 years, tuberculosis as a cause of death in America has been put down from first to seventh place. The death rate from TB has been cut by 80%, and more than 4 million lives have been saved. Yet last year, 50,000 Americans died of tuberculosis. One person every 10 minutes, most of them between the ages of 15 and 44. The cause of tuberculosis is known. The disease can be treated. It can be stopped. It can be wiped out. And yet, lives continue to be wasted every day and every year. The reason? Well, early stages of tuberculosis often have no symptoms of any kind. The sufferer never knows he is ill until the disease has passed the stage where easy treatment is possible, and often has been communicated to family and friends. The only sure way to find out whether or not you are a victim of tuberculosis is to have a regular X-ray made of your chest, and to see to it that your family does the same. An X-ray can reassure you that you are not suffering from tuberculosis, or it can show the very beginnings of the disease so that medical science can get to work on it at once. In many communities, the Public Health Service will X-ray your chest free or at nominal cost. But even if you have to pay your physician a few dollars, it's well worth it. So don't take chances with tuberculosis. Check your chest. Get a chest X-ray today. And now back to Bob Ripley's radio auditorium.
And now we take you to that modern Marco Polo, Bob Ripley, reporting by shortwave transcription from headquarters for the Believe It or Not expedition in Honolulu, Hawaii. Come in, Bob Ripley in Honolulu.
Greetings, everybody. The Believe It or Not expedition is on its way home, and once again I'm speaking to you from beautiful Honolulu. We have seen some strange sights and met some unusual people since we passed through here on our way to the Far East, and we've only just passed through the South Seas, where the islands are so numerous that they're called islanders. It's estimated that there must be at least 1 million islands in the vast expanses of the South Pacific. And one of the most mysterious and ghastly places in the world, I believe, is a weird island called Kerguelen, which means desolation. There is no human life on Kerguelen, and with good reason. The entire island is overgrown with millions of poisonous cabbages, 3 feet in diameter, and just to make things cozy, the island swarms with gigantic spiders, believe it or not. Another island is called Nauru. Is the only place in the world where the sun rises and sets at exactly 6 o'clock all the year round. On New Britain, our Marines found the reveille birds, and they used them instead of alarm clocks because the birds sang only at 4 o'clock in the morning. And on the island of Rapa Iti, the population consists of 198 women and only 4 men. But on New Guinea, the women do all the work and they wear bells around their necks so that their husbands know where their wives are and whether they are loafing or not. But for sheer unbelievability, you will have to visit the island of Truk, which was a Jap naval base during the war. On Truk, the people used rat tails for money. At one time, Truk was overrun by huge rats, which would travel in packs and swoop down on a village and eat all the food. To meet the menace, The Japs put on a 1 yen bounty on each rat tail turned in. But instead of turning in the rat tails, the natives began using them for currency, and before the war, you could buy a pocket knife or a wife for about 3 rat tails. But it's been an exciting and worthwhile trip, this Believe It or Not expedition, and I've returned with enough oddities for many, many cartoons and radio programs. And tomorrow, we leave Honolulu for home, and when you next hear my voice, I'll be on the mainland of the greatest country on earth. And now it's time to say goodbye. A few moments ago, a little native girl came aboard our ship, the President Cleveland, and she presented me with a lei of white blossom. And she reached up and kissed me. And she said in Hawaiian,
Aloha, tele ana no wau, mo ihu na mai.
Which means, you go away, but like the tide and the setting sun, you will return again. Aloha.
Believe it or not.
That was Bob Ripley reporting from headquarters for his Believe It or Not expedition in Honolulu, Hawaii. Bob is on his way back to the United States now, and on his next in-person broadcast, he'll have more fantastic and bizarre discoveries to tell us about. Meanwhile, remember that dramatized sketches from the famous drawing board of Bob Ripley are heard Monday through Friday at this time. The Believe It or Not program was dramatized for radio by George Lefferts. If you want to match Believe It or Not experiences with Bob Ripley, you're invited to write him, care of Believe It or Not, NBC, Radio City, New York. Listen in next program for another fascinating radio edition of Believe It or Not.
This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.
Are you a psychopathic wacko? Are you uncomfortable in your current surroundings? Are you looking for a new place to hole up and hide out? Come to beautiful Montana, the last best place, and the last place anyone would ever look for you. Montana has a long heritage of being a place to hide, from Charles Manson's summer home on Flathead Lake, Ted Bundy's Buffalo Ranch, even Jimmy Hoffa buried in the floor of the Metro Park Arena. Miles and miles of beautiful countryside with neighbors that will leave you alone to mail your bombs and print your bad checks. Unless you tick them off, then they'll form a posse and take care of you themselves. So if you're the nutcase leader of a fringe extremist racist uneducated inbred child abusing wife beating couldn't follow a law if you wrote it yourself, ostracized by family and friends because you're a loony, like to wear a camisole and pumps with your camouflage, your last girlfriend ate from a trough and slept in a barn, fraudulent waste of oxygen hate group, then come on in to Montana. But be warned, we'll find you soon.
Two-Timer by Frederick Brown. This is a LibriVox recording. Reading by Greg Marguerite. 1. Experiment. The first time machine, gentlemen, Professor Johnson proudly informed his two colleagues. True, it is a small-scale experimental model. It will operate only on objects weighing less than 3 pounds 5 ounces and for distances into the past and future of 12 minutes or less. But it works. The small-scale model looked like a small scale, a postage scale, except for 2 dials in the part under the platform. Professor Johnson held up a small metal cube. Our experimental object, he said, is a brass cube weighing 1 pound 2.3 ounces. First, I shall send it 5 minutes into the future. He leaned forward and set one of the dials on the time machine. Look at your watches, he said. They looked at their watches. Professor Johnson placed the cube gently on the machine's platform. It vanished. 5 minutes later, to the second, it reappeared. Professor Johnson picked it up. Now, 5 minutes into the past. He set the other dial. Holding the cube in his hand, he looked at his watch. It is 6 minutes before 3 o'clock. I shall now activate the mechanism by placing the cube on the platform at exactly 3 o'clock. Therefore, the cube should, at 5 minutes before 3, vanish from my hand and appear on the platform, 5 minutes before I place it there. How can you place it there, then? Asked one of his colleagues. It will, as my hand approaches, vanish from the platform and appear in my hand to be placed there. 3 o'clock. Notice, please. The cube vanished from his hand. It appeared on the platform of the time machine. See? 5 minutes before, I shall place it there. It is there. His other colleague frowned at the cube. But, he said, what if now that it has already appeared 5 minutes before you place it there, you should change your mind about doing so and not place it there at 3 o'clock? Wouldn't there be a paradox of some sort involved? An interesting idea, Professor Johnson said. I had not thought of it, and it will be interesting to try. Very well. I shall not... There was no paradox at all. The cube remained. But the entire rest of the universe, professors and all, vanished. 2. Sentry. He was wet and muddy and hungry and cold, and he was 50,000 light-years from home. A strange blue sun gave light, and the gravity, twice what he was used to, made every movement difficult. But in tens of thousands of years, this part of war hadn't changed. The flyboys were fine with their sleek spaceships and their fancy weapons. When the chips are down, though, it was still the foot soldier, the infantry, that had to take the ground and hold it foot by bloody foot. Like this damned planet of a star he'd never heard of until they'd landed him here. And now it was sacred ground because the aliens were there, too. The aliens, the only other intelligent race in the galaxy. Cruel, hideous, and repulsive monsters. Contact had been made with them near the center of the galaxy after the slow but difficult colonization of a dozen thousand planets, and it had been war at sight. They'd shot without even trying to negotiate or to make peace. Now, planet by bitter planet, it was being fought out. He was wet and muddy and hungry and cold, and the day was raw with a high wind that hurt his eyes. But the aliens were trying to infiltrate, and every sentry post was vital. He stayed alert, gun ready, 50,000 light-years from home, fighting on a strange world and wondering if he'd ever live to see home again. And then he saw one of them, crawling toward him. He drew a bead and fired. The alien made that strange, horrible sound they all make. Then it lay still. He shuddered at the sound and sight of the alien lying there. One ought to be able to get used to them after a while, but he'd never been able to. Such repulsive creatures they were, with only two arms and two legs, ghastly white skins and no scales. End of Two Timer by Frederick Brown.
Well, I guess we've come to the end of the so-called dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions, and we're going to fade off here into music. But before I do that, I want to remind everybody that you can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You know, it's not like I know what I'm doing here, so if you have any suggestions or you just want to tell me where to go, feel free. If you have an old radio show that you remember that's in this vein that we do here, tell me about it. I'll see if I can find it and play it. I'd also like to encourage you to visit the website, which is where the show notes are kept. The website, not surprisingly, is www.nighttransmissions.com. Night Transmissions is one word, no space or underscore or anything between the night and the transmission. Just Night Transmissions. Okay, well, I'm going to shut up now. I think I mentioned before that my mother always told me that if you don't think too good, you shouldn't think too much. I've always taken that to heart, and I've extended that to think that perhaps if you don't host too good, you shouldn't host too much. I hope you won't hold that against me and will continue to drop by and listen to these old radio programs.
Will you come to the bar? I have shaded for you. Our bed shall be roses, all spangled with dew. Will you come to the bar? I have shaded for you. Our bed shall be roses, all spangled with dew. Will you come to the bower? Will you come to the bower? There under the bower, on roses you lie, with a blush on your cheek and a smile in your eye. There under the bower, on roses you lie, with a blush on your cheek and a smile in your eye. Will you come to the bower? Will you come to the bough?
I am stretched on your grave, and I'll lie here forever. If your hands were in mine, I'd be sure they would not sever my apple tree, my brightness. It's time we were together. For I smell of the earth, and I'm worn by the weather. When my family think that I'm safely in my bed, oh, from morn until night, I am stretched out at your head, calling out unto the earth with tears and wild for the loss of the girl that I loved as a child. Do you remember the night, oh, the night when we were lost in the shade of the blackthorn and the torch of the frost? Oh, and thanks be to Jesus, pillar of light. All the priests and the friars, they approach me in dread. Oh, for I love you still.
Buckeye and white sycamore, I'm leaving you behind. Oh, I've been a coal man all my life, laying down track in the hole. Got a back like an ironwood bent by the wind, blood veins blue as the coal. Blood veins blue as the coal. Somebody said that's a strange tattoo you have on the side of your head.
I said that's the mark of the number 9 coal. A little more and I'd be dead. Oh, but I love the rumble and I love the dark. I love the cool of the slate. But it's going down that new road looking for a job. This traveling and looking I hate. This traveling and looking I hate. I've stood for the union, walked in the line, fought against the company. I've stood for the UMW of A, now who's gonna stand for me? Well, I got no home and I got no pay, just got a worried soul. And this blue tattoo on the side of my head, left by the number 9 coal, left me by the number 9. Heaven, the land of my dreams, I won't have to worry on losing my job to bad times and big machines. Well, I got no job and I got no pay, just got a worried soul. And this blue tattoo on the side of my head, left by the number 9 coal, left by the number 9 coal.
だが、こぼれないように思い出す春の日、ひとりぼっちの夜に上を向いて歩こう、滲んだ星を 数えて思い出す夏の日、ひとりぼっちの夜、幸せは雲の上に、幸せは空の上に。 涙がこぼれないように泣きながら歩く一人ぼっちの夜。 ひとりぼっちの夜、悲しみは星の影に、悲しみは月の影に、上を向いて歩こう、涙がこぼれ 泣きながら歩く一人ぼっちの夜、一人ぼっちの夜。
Looking for a fragrance that is her own unique scent.
Cool, Luft.
fromage.
I know. I am designer Geoffrey Beans, and I have a new fragrance so overwhelming it practically announces itself.
Coupe le fromage.
Yes, coupe le fromage. The silent but deadly scent that turns a crowded room into a quiet place for you and you alone.
Coupe le fromage.
It surrounds you with your own smell, as pungent as opium, as lethal as poison. Coupe le fromage, the aroma that says, anybody got a match?
Coupe le fromage.
Just look for the bottle shaped like a finger and give it a pull. Yes, she who smelt it, dealt it.
Coupe le fromage.
In English.
Cut the cheese.
For her, coupe le fromage. And for the outdoor man, windbreaker.
Ah.
Wear it and be alone.